Chapter 25. Despite the fact that they now knew Gideon had a working pair of vocal reeds and the will to use them, the trip down to the facility was spent in silence. Any travel into the depths of the first house put both of the teens on high alert. They were so paranoid they would have been welcomed into the dark bosom of the suspicious ninth. Both startled at every shadow and watched the passing by of creaking skeletons with no little hate and despair. They did not like the open terrace, where the waves howled far below, nor the cool marble hallway, nor the marble stairwell that led down to the nondescript room with the hatch to the facility. They only spoke when Gideon slipped her facility key into the hatch and turned it with a sharp click. It was Jean-Marie, and she was troubled.
"We still don't have a key," she said. "Maybe we shouldn't be here."
"Abigail died, and she had permission," said her counterpart somberly. "Who cares?"
"I'm just saying."
"I've been down without permission," said Gideon, as she used one booted foot to ease the hatch open. Cold air wheezed out like a pent-up ghost. "The sixth let me in once without a key, and I'm still breathing." Jean-Marie seemed uncomforted and unconvinced, so she added, "Hey, look at it this way. You were down here just the other night, so if that's the sticking point, you're already totally boned."
"You don't talk like
how I thought you might talk," said Isaac.
All three travelled down the cold, dark staple ladder to the fluorescent lights and dead stillness of the landing. Gideon went first. The other two lagged behind a little, captivated by the increasingly old and bloody gobbets that still decorated the grill at the bottom. She had to herd them forward, down the tunnel that led to the radial room, to the ancient whiteboard and the signs above the warren of corridors. She turned. Jean-Marie and Isaac had not come with her. Jean-Marie had stopped in the doorway, pressing herself flat against it, looking around at the strange anachronistic tunnels of steel and plate metal and LED lighting.
"I thought I heard a noise," she said, eyes darting back and forth.
"Coming from where?" She didn't answer. Isaac, who had pressed himself into the shadows where the side of the doorway met the wall, said,
"Ninth. Why were bone fragments found in Magnus's body and in Abigail's?"
"Don't know. It's a good question."
"At first I thought it meant the skeletons," he said in a sunken whisper,
which made sense from the nonsense of why he and his cavalier had jumped at the creaking approach of each bone servant in the place.
"There's something unnatural about the constructs upstairs, like they're listening to you."
Gideon looked back at both of them. They had pressed themselves into either side of the corridor, not daring to come into the open space, pupils very dilated as though with adrenaline. They both looked at her. The young cavalier with her brown eyes muddy in the darkness, the young necromancer with his deep hazel eyes and spider-leggy mascara. Pressurized air from some cooling fan wheezed through a vent, making the ceiling creak.
"Come on, don't just lurk there," said Gideon impatiently. "Let's find this guy. It shouldn't be too hard. He's massive."
Neither wanted to be coaxed out. Their puff had seemed to leave them. They clustered close together, grave-faced and tense. Isaac raised a hand and faint ghost-like flames appeared at his fingertips, bluish, greenish, giving off a sickly little light that did not do much to illuminate what was going on around them. He insisted on warding every single radiating doorway, daubing blood and his cavalier spit around the mouth of each corridor. He was nervous and crabby, and it was slow work applying team gunge to every single exit.
"His enclosures are good," Jean-Marie kept saying defensively.
"I thought the fourth were meant to be all about head-first dives and getting all crazy," said Gideon, who stared hard into every shadow.
"It's stupid to get killed if it doesn't help," said Isaac, tracing his thumb in curious shapes along the doorjamb. "The fourth isn't cannon fodder. If we're first on the ground, we need to stay alive. Wards were the first thing I learned. When we get shipped out next year, we'll get them scarified onto our backs.
Next year.
Gideon was taut with impatience, but still spent a couple of seconds grappling with the notion that the gawky teens in front of her would be facing the Empire's foes at age 15 and whatever. For all that she'd longed to be on the front lines from the age of 8 up, it suddenly didn't seem like such a great idea.
We wanted to go this year, said the Cavalier dolorously, but Isaac got mumps a week before deployment.
Remembrance of Isaac's mumps threw them both into gloom, but at least that diluted their terror. In the end, Gideon found herself leading them down the hallway marked Sanitizer, the place where she had first found Harrow. Their three pairs of feet kicked up huge scuffs of white powder, glowing mixed colours under Isaac's necrolite, settling down in silent sprays in the panel grouting, grinding to nothing beneath their footsteps. The doors moaned open to the panelled maze of stainless steel cubicles, and the vents moaned too in sympathy, creaking so much that the teens both gritted their molars. Hera's old blood was still here, but Protesilaus wasn't. They all split up to walk the maze of metal tables, checking beneath them to see if he had lain down for a swift nap or something equally probable. They prowled rows of metal cubicles, all empty. They called out, "Hello!" and "Protesilaus!" their voices reverberating thinly off the walls. As the echoes faded, they heard the scuttling noises of air being blown through the vent's metal teeth.
"There's something here," Isaac said.
They all listened. Gideon could hear nothing but the sounds of old machinery running in the same exhausted way it had run for thousands of years, kept alive by perfect mechanism and necromantic time. They were no different from the background noises of the Ninth House. She said, "I can't hear it."
"It's not just hearing," said Isaac, brow furrowing. "It's more what I'm feeling. There's movement here,"
Jean-Marie said.
"Another house?"
"No."
"Wards?"
"Nothing."
She stalked the facility with her rapier drawn and her dagger clutched in her hand. Gideon, stranger to teamwork, worried that if she startled her by accident, she'd end up with the Fourth's offhand in her gut. Isaac said,
"Bodies were brought into here a long time ago. A lot of bone matter. The first feels like a graveyard all over, but this is worse. I'm not faking."
"I believe you," said Gideon. "Some of the stuff I've seen down here would ruin your eyelids. I don't know what the hell they were researching, but I don't like it. Only bright side is that it's all pretty self-contained."
"I'm not super certain," said the adept. Sweat was beading on his brow.
Jean-Marie said,
"He's not in here. Let's go somewhere else."
They left the bright antiseptic room of Sanitizer. The lights went off with rhythmic boom, boom, booms as Gideon pressed down on the touchpad that still held little black whirls of Hera's blood, and they spilled out into the corridor. Sweat was openly dripping down the sides of Isaac's temples now. His Cavalier threw her arm over his shoulder, and he buried his hot, wet face in her shoulder. Gideon again found this difficult to look at.
"Let's bounce," said Jean-Marie.
As they turned the corner to where the sanitizer corridor met the main artery, the rhythmic boom, boom, boom of light shutting down caught up with them. The lights in the grill beneath them winked out of existence, and so did the dully glowing panels above, and so did the bright lights ringing the big square room ahead. They were left in total darkness, every nerve in Gideon's body singing with fear. She ripped her glasses off to try to cope. The necromancer was close to hyperventilating. His Cavalier kept saying with eerie calm,
"Your wards aren't tripped. It's just the lights. Don't freak out."
"The wards
aren't tripped. You're good with wards. There's nobody down here."
One of the motion sensor lights struggled back on behind them, a short way down the passage. A ceiling panel threw the metal siding into sharp white relief. It was daubed with words that had not been there a few seconds before, written in blood so fresh and red that there were little drips.
Death to the fourth house!
The light flickered off. After no sleep, after days of threat and grief and panic that would have floored a man twice his age, Isaac lost it completely. With a strangled cry, he flared in a halo of blue and green. Jean-Marie yelled, "Isaac, behind me!" But he was sizzling with light, too bright to see by, a sun and not a person. Gideon heard him flee into the room ahead of them, blinded by the running aurora. When her eyes cleared, Gideon was confronted with the biggest skeletal construct she had ever seen. The room was full of it, bluely aflame with Isaac's light, a massed hallucination of bones. It was bigger by far than the one in response, bigger than anything recorded in a ninth history textbook. It had assembled itself into the room by no visible means, since it never could have fit through one of the doors. It was just simply, suddenly, there, like a nightmare, a squatting, vertiginous hulk, a nonsense of bones feathering into long, spidery legs, leaning back on them fearfully and daintily, trailing jellyfish stingers made up of millions and millions of teeth, all set into each other like a jigsaw. It shivered its stingers, then stiffened all of them at once with a sound like a cracking whip. There was so much of it! It was cringing away from Isaac Tetteras, who had planted his feet wide in line with his hips and was screaming soundlessly in fear and anger. He had thrown his arms out wide as though in embrace, and there was a sodium explosion in the air between him and the room-cramping construct. It left a suction, like he was trying to drag something out of the unwilling creature. Bright blue points of contact appeared on it, and the mass of bone and energy began to lose form, drifting instead toward Isaac, tiny bones plinking down to the grill like rain. Gideon woke from her confusion, drew her sword, and ran. With a gauntleted hand, she picked up the nearest stinger and yanked it, then smashed the back of her heavy glove into another, finding a naked shank of leg bone and punching it as hard as she could. One of the tendrils of teeth wrapped around her ankle, but she found purchase and stamped it into a corona of molars. Gideon looked behind her to see Jean-Marie whipped off her feet by another tendril, lashing out wildly with her feet and her blades. Everywhere she looked was filled with construct. Everywhere Isaac's light touched, there was a veritable cancer of bone and tooth. Gideon bellowed, voice deadened by 1,000,000,000 frigging bones. "Run! Don't fight it! Run!" But the enormous thing slapped another couple dozen tendrils down on the grill, sinuous and flexed into long, sharp wires. Isaac's blue-green fire fell upon a giant trunk of bone, a skull terrifically mangled into the thing's only coherent core, a simulacrum of a face with closed eyes and closed lips, as though locked perpetually in prayer. This vast mask loomed down from the ceiling and strained beneath Isaac's pull. One of the tendrils gave in and was sucked into the vortex that the fourth house was so valiantly creating. The spirit pinned to it was dissolving, the limb pattering into individual bits, one among hundreds. Isaac did not stop, and he did not run. It was one of the bravest and stupidest things Gideon had ever fucking seen. The construct teetered, getting its footing, cocking its great head as though in contemplation. The long, straight spars of teeth hovered above the necromancer, bobbing and warping occasionally, as though about to be sucked into his fiery gyre. Then at least 50 of them speared him through. Blue fire and blood sprayed the room. Gideon sheathed her sword, set her shoulders, put one arm up above her eyes, and charged through the field like a rocket. It was like running through a landslide. 1,000 fragments of bone ripped her robes to shreds and tore at every inch of exposed skin. She didn't pay them any mind, but crashed into Jean-Marie Chatur like the vengeance of the Emperor. Jean-Marie had no intention of stopping. She was tearing into her unbeatable foe as though running away had never been in question.
She barely seemed to notice that Gideon had grabbed her, her limbs thrashing, her throat one long howl that Gideon only translated later. Fidelity! 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 How she scrambled through that hallway, the other girl clutched to her bosom, long tendrils of bones snaking after them from the central room, she did not know. The fact that she shinnied up the ladder with Jean-Marie attached, kicking and screaming, was even more unlikely. She tossed the cavalier down. She would have been surprised if the girl had even felt it, slammed the hatch lid and turned the key so frantically that it made gouges in the metal. Jean-Marie rolled over on the cold black tiles and she threw up. She pulled herself up on her bone-whipped, cut-up, bashed-in arms and legs, wobbling, and she began to shake. She sank back to her knees and screamed like a whistle. Gideon caught her up again. The grief-stricken teenager thrashed and bit and started off on a jog away from the hatch. Jean-Marie kept kicking in her arms.
Put me down, she wept. Let me go back. He needs me. He could still be alive.
He's seriously not, said Gideon. Jean-Marie the fourth screamed again.
I want to die, she said afterward.
Tough luck. She did at least stop kicking. The myriad cuts over Gideon's hands and face were starting to really sting, but she paid them no mind. It was still a deep black night outside, and the wind was howling around the side of Canaan House. She carried Jean-Marie inside and down the big rotting staircase, and then she absolutely blanked on what to do next. The Fourth House Cavalier couldn't even stand. She was reduced to the small, disbelieving sobs of someone whose heart had broken forever. It was the second time Gideon had listened to Jean-Marie really cry, and the second time was a lot worse than the first. She had to get her to safety. Gideon wanted her longsword, and she wanted her... There were the ninth quarters, but bone wards could be broken, even Harrow's. She could march straight to where the others were guarding Dulcinea, but that was a long way to go with her catatonic cargo, and if she met an avaricious Nibirius or an over-obedient Column, she'd still prefer them to whatever was down there, in the facility, in the dark. Gideon's hand was still gripping the keyring with the facility key she had just now so frantically used, and the red key on it. And lightning struck. Jean-Marie did not ask where they were going. Gideon ran down the soggy Canaan House staircase and across silent nighttime corridors and down the sloping little passage that led to the foyer for the training rooms. She pushed aside the tapestry and sprinted down the hall to the great black door that Harrow had called X-203. The door and the lock were so black in the night and she was so slippery with fear that for an excruciating minute she couldn't seem to find the keyhole. And then she found it, and slid the red key home, and opened the door to the long-abandoned study. The rail of spotlights all lit up, illuminating the clean laminate countertops of the laboratory and the still-shining wooden stairs to the living room. She slammed the door shut behind them and locked it so quickly that it ought to have broken the sound barrier. Gideon half-heaved, half-carried Jean-Marie up the staircase and put her down on the squashy armchair, which wheezed with the sudden use. The sorrowful teen curled into a fetal position, bleeding and hiccuping. Gideon barreled away and started taking stock of the room, wondering if she could haul the big wooden bookcases down as barricades.
Where are we?
The fourth eventually said drearily. One of the key rooms. We're safe here. I'm the only one with a key.
What if it breaks down the door?
Gideon said bracingly. Are you kidding? That thing's 3-inch thick iron. This neither comforted nor satisfied Jean-Marie, who had possibly seen a makeshift blockade in the other girl's eyes, but her crying diminished. Every 5 seconds, another sob would rack her, but she had swapped weeping for hysterical sucked-in breaths until she said,
It's not fair,
and started up again with the great lung-filling fits of tears. Gideon had moved before the aged gun, frightened into wondering whether or not it worked.
Who knew? The swords still all held edges. No, it's not.
You don't understand.
The cavalier was fighting for control, fierce eyes wet with hate and despair. She was shivering so hard that she was vibrating.
Isaac's cautious, not reckless. He's not... He didn't... He was always so careful. He shouldn't have. I hated him when we were little. He wasn't at all what I wanted.
She gave in to crying again. When she could, she said,
It's not fair. Why did he get stupid now?
There was absolutely nothing Gideon could say to this. She needed more firepower than bookcases and antiques. What she badly needed was Hero Nona Jesimus, for whom a gigantic construction of bones would be more fun opportunity than hellish monstrosity. And she needed her longsword. But she couldn't leave Jean-Marie, and right now Jean-Marie was a liability. She mopped her hands over her bleeding face, demolishing her face paint and trying to get her thoughts straight and settled on.
Look, we'll stay in here until you're fighting fit. Don't try to tell me you're fit. You're exhausted, you're in shock, and you look like hot puke. Take half an hour, lie down, and I'll get you some water.
It took an enormous effort to get Jean-Marie onto one of the dusty, mattress-squeaking beds, and much more effort to get her to take even tiny sips of the water that came out of the tap at the laboratory. The pipes rattled in shock that they were being used in a little tin mug that had probably not had anybody's lips near it since the ninth house was young. The recalcitrant teen drank a little, rested her head on the spongy old pillow, and her shoulders shook for a long time. Gideon settled down in the overstuffed armchair and kept her rapier out over her knees.
What was that thing?
Gideon startled. She had been lulled into a fug of reverie, and Jean-Marie's voice was thick with weeping and the pillow.
Dunno,
she said. All I know is that I'm going to kick its ass for it. Another moment's silence. Then...
This is the first time Isaac and me really left the house. I wanted him to sign us up to go out to the front ages ago, but Abigail said no, and he wouldn't. I mean, he's got 3 younger brothers and 4 younger sisters to look after. He had, I mean.
It sounded as though she was going to burst into tears again. Gideon said,
That's a significant amount. You need spares when you're in the fourth house, said Jean-Marie, sniffling. I've got 5 sisters. Do you have a big family?
The ninth doesn't do big families. I think I'm an orphan.
Well, that's pretty fourth house too, said the Cav. My mum jumped on a grenade during the pioneer expedition, even though she wasn't supposed to be out on post-colony planets beyond the rim. Isaac's dad went out on a state visit to hold a planet and got blown up by insurgents.
There was no more after that. Not even tears. After a few minutes, Gideon was not surprised to see that the poor, bloodied girl had cried herself unconscious. She did not wake her. There would be time enough to wake her, and even a short rest would probably do her good. It sucked to be a teen. And it sucked more to be a teen whose best friend had just died in a horrible way, even if you were used to mothers jumping on grenades and fathers getting exploded. At least in the ninth house, the way you usually went was pneumonia, exacerbated by senility. Gideon rested her head on the fat back of the armchair. She would not have said it was at all possible, but watching the rise and fall of Jean-Marie's breath, a safe up-and-down rhythm, the drying tear stains on the sleeping teen's cheeks. She promptly fell asleep.
It couldn't have been long. 15 minutes at the very most.
She startled awake with the sheer unconscious panic of someone realizing they couldn't afford to slip into deep REM, a haptic jerk flicking her awake. Her sword rattled off her knees and jangled to the floor. The only sound that could have woken her was a persistent drip she'd thought was coming from the tap. Gideon did not understand what she was looking at when she awoke, and when she cleared her eyes and looked properly, she still didn't understand. Jean-Marie was still lying prone in the old bed, arms and legs now flung wide, as if she had kicked off the blankets and sheets in a bad dream. This would have been fine, except for the huge shafts of bones spearing each shoulder to the mattress, two more through the thighs, one straight through the very centre of her ribs. These spears of bone met Jean-Marie's body with halos of red splotching through her clothes, seeping into the bedspread.
No, said Gideon meditatively.
No, 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 no!
Jean-Marie's eyes were very slightly open. There was blood spattered in her curls, and there was blood spattered over the headboard. Gideon's gaze followed the splatter upward. Written on the wall in silky wet red was, "Sweet dreams."